So welcome to everybody. I'm Deborah Newton-Kamen. So I just want to say, after yesterday's talk, I was pregnant in the pulpit twice. And it actually seemed to all be fine, including 9 months pregnant on Yom Kippur 1 year. Wow. And the only thing that really happened after that was I abstained 9 months before the holidays for the rest of that for the rest of my life because I didn't want to do that again. But and every year people asked me, right? And every year people asked me on the high holidays if I was pregnant again. So I guess it made an impression. But you know, but in any case, so and I've done this for a very long time. I've been at this, as you heard, for those of you that were there yesterday, I've been at the same congregation for 25 years. Came right out of school. When I graduated, of course, I changed, you know, change was like, you know, kind of what my life was like, but I had the really naive and young assumption. I remember I came in as the assistant rabbi to the beloved founding rabbi of the congregation, and when he retired, it was not really very clear that they were going to want, then they considered me very young, so I grew out of that, but it was very unclear whether they were going to give a position to a young woman, and it was a very difficult year while they were making the decision, and finally they made the decision that they were going to give me the position. As an aside, that has nothing to do with today's conversation, just, you know, 20% of the congregation resigned at that point.
Wow.
Yeah, so, and then I got the position, and then I thought, now, you know, the changes are all done, and I'll be able to just, you know, relax and consolidate. And because I did not yet really understand at that point in my rabbinate that, like it or not, there was never going to be the possibility that change was going to be done. And the question was really just ultimately how it was going to be done and whether I personally was going to learn how to embrace and promote change in a positive way, or be afraid of it and resistant to it. And then, of course, you know, so you've got all of that as a professional going on in any community that you're in. But I think particularly if you're in a congregation, people are coming, people are going, people are being born, people are dying, people are growing older, you're growing older. So you've got that whole layer of change. And then, of course, you know, the change in society. 25 years ago, I didn't have a cell phone or a laptop or a, changes in our movement, changes that, you know, I mean, we live in the age of, you know, such rapid change. So one way or another, we're all learning how to deal with it and to harness it. And so today's really a conversation about that. And we have two wonderful women on our panel who are going to share their experience and their wisdom. And then hopefully we'll also have the opportunity to open up the conversation.
So one of the things that I wanted to address is the fact that the title that we were assigned is Successful Models. And the question that they have is, how do we define success? When I describe myself, the first thing I said is, I'm a woman, I'm a wife, I'm a mother of two beautiful daughters, and very smart, very good, and the whole thing, you're right? And the question of defining success is a sense of fulfillment. The possibility of being a giver is also because you are a receiver. So the question of successful models is, for me, you know, I'm very against this cliche of breaking ceilings. I don't like the word breaking ceilings. I like the word of building horizons instead of breaking ceilings. I don't like to break things. I like to build. So that's something that was important in my career. If I'm the first woman rabbi in South America, and it was not an easy task. That was in 94, but was not an easy task. And along with Margit Bautmans, which actually originally is from Germany, mm-hmm. we needed to pave the road, and it was not easy, not at the seminary in South America, but actually was much more complicated in a society in which the conservative movement was not very active still, and because Marshall Mayer came, you know, just a few years before that. And so, you know, the Orthodox community was like, you know, we were in every single, I was in every single newspaper, and I was seeing Satan or something like that is coming from hell, you know, just to destroy the Jewish community of South America. And so, and it was very interesting, you know, just to go with my father of blessed memory and just, you know, pass by those newspapers with my pictures, you know, everywhere, and in those kiosks, in those stands, and, you know, and him being very proud and at the same time kind of embarrassed. You know, so it was a very interesting situation. So I really like to build. My husband and I build a lot through music. We love to build community through music. And the other things that we have is we really believe in the big umbrella of Judaism. Although we were ordained in the conservative movement through the Seminario Rabbinico Latino American in South America, and I hope that you understand these two accents. So we did believe actually in this big umbrella of what Judaism is about, and in order to embrace everybody as part of our big tent. Without not being judgmental of people, and so the essence is that Yiddishkeit and that neshama that is coming as a seeker, and not the one that is gonna come as a doer and as a dweller, and you know there's nothing else to look for. So as an introduction before any questions come, I will say that for me. I don't want to say I'm successful. I just, you know, just go with the flow. But for me, it's this issue of not about breaking ceilings, but mostly building horizons of reaching out where the people are, and not just put structures and things that people will can be intimidated by what we are offering. I think that's my. It's great when your kids don't like what they receive for their bnei mitzvah and they leave the courses for you. So that's the way into introduction. I would be like, you know, happy to talk more about that.
Great. So what I was thinking of doing is just to walk together with you a little bit through what has happened before and since ordination, and I think we'll have some points of change or also not change. I'm with Annalia on the issue of what is successful is very difficult to describe. I studied here at JTS in 95, long time ago, as a PhD student from Germany, experiencing, you know, being here for 3 months. It was a tight debate. I think it was the first round of the gay and lesbian issues being debated. But I was living in Brush, and I had this wonderful opportunity of just taking the best of JTS and not needing to go into all the problems and the troubles. So today when Claudia, who was ordained together with me at Shacharit, just added the Imahot and the voices didn't even go down, I remember these moments when the first women would, or men also, would add Imahot into the Tefillah on the Chazara, and voices would become silent, and only a few people would go on with the Imahot, and then everybody would join in again. So this is an amazing feeling still every time I'm there. Actually, at Shechta, where I did rabbinical school, after not leaving out the Imahot when I was the Shlicha Tzibur for the first time, I got this little note in my Dropbox, in my mailbox from David Golinkin, which said, "Giza, tasimi lev, we don't do imahot here."
Okay. I received the same pathetic. Apparently, he just changed. Giza.
So what I then did, whenever I was a shlicha tzibur, I had this very long and nice extended moment of silence after the avot before going on, and he couldn't say anything about that, and I thought that was a very
that was smart.
And Magen Avraham, just staying up there without going down again. So
even more dramatic.
Yeah. So, but that's kind of a side issue. Actually, I feel I got tricked into the conservative movement, and it's appropriate that Rabbi Libo is walking in exactly at that moment because he's the one. Yeah, because you know when I was studying here, it was obvious all the women are fully committed to mitzvot. Everybody is wearing talis and tefillin. The movement is completely egalitarian. There are all these interesting debates, and everybody is learned and knows what they're talking about. So this is what I thought the conservative movement was, which then, when the question of rabbinical school came up, made me obviously decide this is my place, and otherwise I might have, you know, thought I need another place when I realized how the movement really does look. So I'm really happy to got tricked into that, and I think that's part of it. There is a if you are disappointed in Germany, it's more like the word is disillusioned, and I think that's part of the change questions, right? So if you are disappointed, it's enttäuscht in German, means you're losing your illusions about something. And I think so this is a very important step. Whenever you're frustrated with something, like, okay, maybe I had the wrong perception on what was going on, and so I'm getting a clearer view, and that's very helpful. So after I came back from JTS, a friend of mine picked me up at the airport, and we had then afterwards this normal Sunday afternoon conversations, sitting around the table complaining about the situation of the Jewish community in general. You know, a cup of coffee on Sundays, that's what you do. And somehow we came up with this idea, okay, maybe we can do something to change it. So we made a list between us and another friend of 60 people who might be interested in talking about that, and we met at the JCC in Berlin, all these people around the table thinking of what could we do, and then this very revolutionary idea of, that was 95, of maybe let's just get together and do a service by ourselves, came up, and that sounds, for Americans, that sounds very normal, because that's what you do, right? You just get up and start your own thing, as Annalia just said. In Germany, it was revolutionary. Mm-hmm. And then what happened is that my friends were happily taking part in organizing the setup, organizing the food and everything, and I was stuck with organizing the services. Mm. So I ended up leading this Chavura style thing in 95, and we then had a very interesting debate with the board of the larger Berlin Jewish community. I'm not going into the details of German Jewish community structure. I know some around the table have struggled for years to understand it. Right, Jeffrey, you remember how we did that with the RAs. You know, it's a unified community structure, so my salary and the salary of the Orthodox rabbis come from the same pot, and the board of the larger community makes bigger decisions, and the synagogues are only very partially independent. So there was the debate if we should get a permanent space, because we had been meeting just in classrooms, and I had people who came to me and said, you know, we like what you do, but this is just not appropriate. If there's not a synagogue with really, you know, nice wooden benches you are sitting in, doesn't feel like real tefillah. So, okay. So we, in that debate, unification had happened just a couple of years before, and the former big synagogue, new called synagogue on Oranienburgstraße, that's the one with the golden dome, which you have seen on pictures, they renovated it as a museum and an archive and built a small shul into it with a mechitza. For all those, that was the reasoning behind it, and you see how detached German Jewry then was from the rest of the world, because they expected so many American Jews coming to visit, and that was what the American Jews would need. A synagogue with a mechitza, yeah. Right? Which is absolutely... So we got, our little chavura got that space to do services there. And actually, and that I think it's an important piece in the thinking about change also, the first shacharit we did was for our own Ufruf. So, and I think it's a very important and wise thing as a rabbi to juggle and be very conscious about your personal needs and the needs of your family and the congregational needs. So I was absolutely fine, for example, I'm doing that till today. I'm trying always to tutor one bar mitzvah kid by myself to be connected and to really feel I know what's going on and keeping up to date. I choose one of those who my kids love most. And I don't say that to the community in that way, but I'm just very consciously, okay, this is what I do, because they come to our home. If I'm late or I'm on the phone, my kids will have to deal with them, so let them have fun together. And our last Shabbat we had the bar mitzvah, and he said that especially thanking David, my son, for keeping him so good company while he was waiting to start studying with me. And I think it's really it's very important to be conscious about that and not act out your needs with the community, because we also need, you know, we need space, we need friendships, we need everything, and to be very conscious about that and allow it where it's appropriate, and then also not do it where it's not appropriate. So that was the first Shabbat, and then we started doing services, and then I had one of these conversations with Rabbi Libo and other people about, well, what should I do? And Ismael Shorsh, then the chancellor, then said, if you go to rabbinical school, you should go to Israel. We would love to have you here at JTS, but Israel makes more sense in terms of studying the text in Hebrew, in terms of, and that's an additional thing which we weren't aware of, I think, before that, gaining all the authority by coming back with Torah Mitzion, right? And really not having to translate internally everything through English. I see that with our colleague Bea Wieler, who some of you might know, was the first female rabbi after the Shoah in Germany, a JTS graduate, that she was continuously translating through English, because that's how she studied. And it had then an added benefit, so to speak, of some quote of rabbinic authority, that our twins were born in Israel during rabbinical school and during the Intifada. So, you know, with all the secular Israelis who try to run the show because they know Hebrew, etc., to be able to say, I know more about Israel. I've been there during the Intifada. You've been in Berlin for 20 years and very comfortable in here. And to be able to speak up on eye level with the Israelis was a very important step. So coming back in 2002, I did not get hired by the synagogue I founded together with the others, because they went somewhere off to renewal and trying all kinds of other things. So we founded the Masorti Germany as a non-for-profit organization. And I had this idea of starting with a Lehrhaus, going in a Buber Rosenzweig direction, you know, reading the text in the original, it sounds like written for today. And something amazing happened. We did that in our living room. And we had wonderful discussions and Lehrhaus meetings, but as soon as people felt this is a safe space, they started destroying it. We had, I still remember that we did a session on kiddushin and you know, marriage and like studying it halachically, and then two of the participants during the chevruta started shouting at each other. How dare you speak up and try to explain to me what Judaism is? Your parents left in time for Argentina. I was hidden in the woods in Poland and survived. So how dare you tell me what Judaism is about? Which meant we got this backlash of a hurt community, of a traumatized community, of survivors who are the child, who don't even know what they're yearning for, and if they feel something, the psychological need to recreate the brokenness is so strong that they will break it, right? Still it gives me the chills now, even only talking about that. So we changed, I changed the model, and I said, okay, this is not going to work. Rosenzweig is fine, but no. And we went and started a preschool. Also because my kids were that age, I mean, and I felt there's a need for it, but also because I felt, and I was proven true with that, that I could trust the young families that they want a safe and warm and friendly space for their children. And they will do everything, as broken as they are maybe, and as much baggage they are bringing, they will want this warm space for their kids. And this was successful. We started with 7 kids. Now I have to add a little twist to that, which was really very funny. We designed it as a bilingual Hebrew-German preschool because I thought this way we will attract all the committed families who really want a deep Jewish education. Now guess what? Instead we got the secular Israelis. So we started with 7 kids, 6 from the staff of the Israeli embassy. And I still remember one of the parents when I went to the Israeli embassy to talk about it, he would look at the flyer and say, "Katuf po tfilah." Like completely in shock. So well, you know, the worst which will happen is your kid will like it, and even worse than that, you might start liking it. So we grew from the 7 Israeli embassy kids to today 77 kids in 5 groups, 3 of them bilingual Hebrew-German, so we kept that model, 2 of them English-German, and we have all the time between 10 and 15 languages of origin in the kindergarten, ranging from, I mean, the obvious, you know, English-German, Hebrew, Russian, Ukrainian, Spanish, we even had, I'm blanking out, Telugu, an Indian language, because it was a Jewish-Indian mixed family, so the father would speak. And then we had to deal with, they are doing a Hindu ceremony for the kid, and the Brit Mila thing, so, okay, that's fine. Portuguese, and so just you know, keep counting. Russian, and we managed to create this safe space. I was the rabbi in a smaller congregation in southern Germany, which mostly Russian immigrants, and then I was appointed a rabbi back at the Oranienburgerstraße in 2007. And I've been the rabbi there since, and I hope to be there for a long time. The synagogue had developed in this, started as a chavura, as I said before, and had developed in a very experiential situation with a lot of tension and lots of fights going on. So when I came, there were people during Kaddish, I had that once, standing up shouting at each other, "Shut up, this is my Kaddish to say." Right? So it took me several years to remove the shouting and the fighting from the synagogue, first into the, you know, membership room, then to my office and say, you know, we are not shouting about these things. I'm not going to have a vote if we do Kol Nidre, which there's a Lewandowski Kol Nidre, which goes with German. We are not going to vote if we're going to do that with German. We're going to study and then I will decide. I had people leaving about that, because how can you come? And I think there was a gender issue in that, like being a female rabbi. They would have accepted a male rabbi much better, I think. But I had people also would then come and say, thanks for doing this. And again, I won by bringing young families in who then would tell the others, you are not going to fight in front of my children. Mm-hmm. So we managed to dip into the resources of people as broken and damaged as they are, wanting to take care of their kids and being able to dream about a better world for the children. And you know, recently I've come to the point we don't believe in you can prove the existence of God, right? So all these, you remember all these theological debates in the Middle Ages and so on, like proving the existence of God. My theory right now is, I haven't, you know, worked it out, but just to throw it out at you, if there's any proof of the existence of God, it's our deep inner longing and our somehow feeling that there must be a world that is whole and not broken. there is a longing, even within people having these trauma experiences or coming from traumatized families, there is something within us which keeps us looking out for something whole and holy. I think that's so. I have worked very hard not to make any changes, and I owe that to Rabbi Rivon Crigier, who's a Masorti rabbi in Paris, who told me, I went to Levi Wyman Kelman in the Kollel Neshama, and to him, and asked them for advice. Say, you know, give me one thing which you feel you have done right creating your communities. And Rivon said, I did not do any changes in the first year. I sat there during Tfilot, sweating because it was so horrible, and kept my mouth shut. I didn't manage to really do that for a year, but to to keep changes down and to build trust and to build friendship and to build that first. I mean, my cantor still complained that I changed everything. So what I did change, obviously, is that during the Chazarat Hashatz, you can already sit down after the Kiddushah and don't keep standing for the Shamru. In the Chazarat Hashatz in the morning, because she did the Veshamru, the evening melody, because she didn't know what the difference is, so she had people stand for that, and I just sat down, so that's a big change, which she was angry about. It has taken me 7 years, and I feel like only now we are in the synagogue at the point of getting to all these wise things that are written about, having committees and building structures and volunteer leadership. I've just been reading Chuck Simon's book again. And I think the big thing is hanging in there and believing that there is something which is coming into existence. Another area where I felt the most important piece in being able to change is keep hanging in there and not changing anything. There are two areas. One is that I kept my mouth shut on Israeli politics, which is in Germany, you know, it's right or wrong my country in a very extreme way, and I would have disqualified my being a rabbi by saying anything. I'm harvesting the fruits of that now because pass it out later. We just started building a 3-religion preschool house in Berlin. So we hope to open that next fall with a Christian, the Lutheran congregation of all Berlin. They run 27 kindergartens, and they are partnering with us. And a lovely Muslim congregation who in their self-description, the third paragraph says, in our congregation, racism, extremism, fundamentalism, and anti-Semitism does not have a space. Wow. And that's amazing. I mean, this is just... So I feel that by having kept my mouth shut on Israel, I am now able to say we are doing this for the sake of our children, for the sake of our city, of our country, maybe of our continent. I mean, we're talking on a European level also. And not being branded as... the lefty female strange rabbi anyways, so to be taken serious on that. And I think that's another women's issue, obviously, too. How do you manage to be taken serious? And the other issue, which I have walked a very tiny, complicated path, is on the gay and lesbian issues, where I was always within the synagogue, outspoken. I went on Keshet rabbis as soon as it, even trembling, you know, when there were like two other rabbis in all of Europe on the Keshet rabbis list saying we are gay and lesbian friendly. And I told many friends, no, I'm happy to bring good friends over who will do a gay or lesbian chuppah. I won't do it, not because I don't believe in it, but we have had and we are going to have more Shabbat chatan v'chatan or kala v'chala ufrovs for so we are working our way very slowly into that, and to balance this, and I think that's another change issue again, to balance between the values and to know you have to let go on some things in order to be able to do the other things, right? And to keep to to keep to the big picture. I think that's another, isn't it?
It's a very diasporic thing that you are talking about, because it's, you know, I have that experience in Chile to go very, very slowly. And, you know, we spent almost 6 years in Chile. It was a beautiful congregation. When in 1994 we came back from Israel and were ordained there, and the Tekes was in Buenos Aires, we came back on July 15, 1994. On July 18 was the JCC bombing, where our very dear friend Susie Kramer was killed. And so we spent Tisha B'Av with the Kramers, and since I was coming with all this, you know, fantasy and this, what's it, idealistic distortion of what the rabbinate will be in South America. We spend, you know, Tisha B'Av, you know, after Tisha B'Av, we have the Seudah there, and at 2 o'clock in the morning, I said to Susie, "I go to work tomorrow morning. You know, just stay here at home. Let's just, you know, have a whole night here together, and let's just celebrate together." And that was the reason we left Argentina, actually. I don't know if some of you know me, but I'm a medical doctor, and so I was sent to the morgue for 3 weeks. And so I, you know, since I was a rabbi and I was a medical doctor, I was able to manage, right, emotionally being in the morgue for 3 weeks. So I decided not to go back to Argentina. I said, I couldn't sleep for over a year, and I decided not to go back to Argentina. I went back to Israel. We studied another thing. I finished my residency in Hadassah. And when we went back to visit, we went back to visit a very small synagogue, beautiful synagogue like Monaco, but without the French, in Chile. And it was absolutely fabulous. It was a beautiful place. And we stayed there for 5.5 years. Our youngest daughter was born there. And I finished my PhD there, actually. And so what you are saying is exactly what happened in a small community somewhere else, in which you have to do a whole transplant. They invited me to be the rabbi. I signed a contract as the rabbi. My husband did too. So I was able to do everything but Barin Sheve Kedusha. I was not able to say Bar Hu, okay? I was not able to read Torah, but I was in charge of preparing everybody else to read Torah. Okay, so interestingly enough, 5.5 years later, when we left, and we loved that place, but when we left, I left a group of kids that wanted to, you know, take charge of the congregation, because no rabbi was hired yet. And I took all these kids and I said, let's do a Talmud Torah, just, you know, for Shlechei Tzibur. And I have 15 girls coming and no boys. So here we are, leaving a congregation. Me as a woman in the rabbinate with a contract that couldn't say but who, leaving 15 girls in charge, and they did Yamim Noraim there. They did everything. So they waited until that moment, and so you really do, you know, small steps. Mm-hmm. They waited until that moment, and they took over the synagogue, and 6 months later they hired another rabbi. Mm-hmm. And so, of course, it was much different when we came to the United States. It was like, but we also start with, you know, with small steps. My, going back to the topic here, is I was always trying to find a way of merging my rabbinate, as Patit rabbi, with my medical part, and I found a niche in women struggling with infertility, and that was something that I counsel a lot, but then started growing. It was, you know, started in the basement of our home. You know, we have a very Latino style home, which you drop in and, you know, just people come and just sit there and open the refrigerator and take the hummus. And so it's a very, very, very non-formal way of leading things. And the home is literally always open. We do a lot of things in our home. We do a lot of Abdallah. We have Shabbat dinners. I mean, we always host people basically every Friday night, and a lot of Abdallah at home, and, you know, Tikkun Leil Shavuot and whatever is coming. It's the way we love to do it, and so home is extremely important to feel that way. Shalom, remember Yaakov Rosenberg, for those of you of Zichron Libracha. I remember coming into Schechter one day, and he hugged me, and he said, "Don't be a rabbi, be a rebbe." And I always remember that. And so, you know, home is always open. And so the feeling of dealing with women that are struggling with infertility was a way of, for me, of merging both things. And we started this group now 9 years ago in the basement of our home, and then we grew up, we went to a JFNCS, and I wrote a book about that and the whole thing. We have over 100 kids from that group today, from those women, you know, through different ways of, you know, IVF and different other ways, but we have over 100 kids born from that group. I mean, you know, women are graduating, meaning they have their children. We go to the mikveh together. We do a whole celebration about that, and you know, and then we move on. And it has been a very beautiful way of realizing that rabbinate really transcends and gets into the very personal life. We have a bima with the duchan. We don't have a bima. Or we don't have a bama, I will say. We built our own shul. With the help of our people, we built our own shul that now is about 400 families. And in our own building, actually, it's all eco-oriented. It's eco-kosher, as we call it. It's all, you know, recycled from a paint shop. From a car paint shop, and so it's very simple. We call it the light that comes from within. We don't need a lot of stuff there. It's really very simple, and it's very beautiful, and it's full with kids. We never talk about the noise of kids. We always talk about the sound of kids. It's full with kids. We have had people leave in the shul because they were upset that the kids were making noise, and they started texting me. And then when I saw Motzei Shabbat, when did they text me about the noise of the kids, I realized I was during the Amida on Friday night. anyway, so those type of things do happen. We have a big sign that says "Turn off your cell phones," but nevertheless. And also, we have a very interesting congregation because we have people coming from a secular background. Lots of Israelis coming from a secular background. We have people coming from the Reform background all the way to Chabad. And they're coming from different reasons. And I think that what they are looking is at a very embracing type of model, the big tent in which everybody is welcome without judgmental you know, approaches. And those are the things that I love the most. The real thing is, you know, to be present with every single person. When somebody tells something, to be present there, for me, is extremely important. I have a good memory, but the reason I remember, you know, things that I have in those conversations is mostly because in every conversation I have, if I'm not present, I'm bleeding. But if I'm present, I'm present. And for me, it's important because it's a dual way of receiving as well. You know, we are all in a very beautiful status, which is being part of people's lives, in which they become part of your life, and the sense of transcendence, being immanent but also being transcendent. It's something that I think that it's a privilege. That we should take it as an honor, as a privilege when somebody comes and is confident with you and they put this trust. And when people leave, I always say the same thing. You know, when people come with their own surahs and they leave the office, and they always say the same thing: thank you for your trust. I mean, just to come and pour out, you know, this catharsis of what's going on in their lives, and just do it with you and to trust you, I always say thank you for your trust. It will be much easier to go to somebody they don't know or they pay for, you know, just to do that catharsis. So that's how I define success. It's just to be present in people's lives, and because they become present in your life as well. And we also started a religious school at the basement. With 6 kids the first week, 9 the second week, and now we have 90 kids in that religious school. Most of our kids go to day school. But we have 90 kids in our religious school, and it's just a blessing. It's really beautiful. And lots of adult education programs and lots of activities in interfaith, actually, activities. We have lots of them. It's a blessing, I think it's a blessing. Eloai neshama shetnadat avi tehorai, that the sense of being, the sense of kedusha. Every single day you wake up with that sense of kedusha, because you're making, you know, making a difference.
So, what is the name of your...
Or Hadash, we chose the name. That was the name. Yeah, anybody knows Maurizio Walter? Mm-hmm. Okay, from Masopi. So, when Maurice is a very, very good friend, dear friend, who's here now, and when he left Buenos Aires to go and study in Israel, he left my husband and myself, his congregation. That was a congregation called Or Hadash. When we left that congregation to go and study in Israel, and Mauricio was coming back, because, you know, we just basically did a revolving door, was coming back, the president of that shul, Isaac Elmeses, has said to us, what do you want us to give you as a present, you know, because you are leaving. You know, we studied that single, and we got married, and we have our first daughter there. And so what do you want? And I said, I want the key of the shul. And I said, what do you mean the key of the shul? It's 63, you know, cents. You know, it's a piece of bronze. And I said, this is home for me. I want the key of my shul. And so that congregation is Or Hadash. So when our synagogue started, and the people that, you know, put it together asked us, how do you want this synagogue to be called? We didn't even consult with each other. We just look at each other as Or Hadash.
So I thought we would open it up to questions or insights, have a bit of a, you know, have a discussion.
I just wanted to react. What you're doing is stunning, and it's so different. We're celebrating 30 years of the ordination of women. I want to go back 34 years. Eitan was a year old. I was asked to be the rabbi of the great synagogue in Brussels.
Wow.
They're named Naraim through Simchat Torah. They offered a job. Mm-hmm. The consistoire had to meet on my candidacy. They were willing to hire me, conservative rabbi coming out of JTS, and letters were sent from throughout Europe that if I was hired, it would mean the end of European Jewry.
Wow.
I found some of those letters.
Wow.
Hanging out my files.
Wow.
European Jewry is not dead.
Wow.
In large measures because of Jewry. So thank you. So
thank you.
Did you get up?
I had to withdraw my candidacy. They gave all kinds of conditions of how I would be hired. I pulled back my candidacy. I actually was asked to serve as a weekend rabbi in Nice before Yishayahu Dalfas was the rabbi. Uh-huh. So we went to Nice for Shabbat.
Yeah. That's not bad.
So they saw the need for a rabbi as opposed to a rabbinical school student.
Right.
So as I now go into my emeritus phase, maybe I'll go back to Europe.
Wonderful. Yes, please.
Hi, Jen Schlossberg. Thank you both so much for sharing this. And I noticed that you both referenced young families, or, you know, at least targeting the young family population. And I'm wondering how you work with one community, a subpopulation within your larger population, if you can share any thoughts as to how to do that without alienating or upsetting others that maybe you're not targeting at that particular time or for that particular initiative.
I must say I haven't been too successful with that.
Okay.
So I was trying to, at least, first of all, I felt it's very important to always say that. So, you know, I've been repeating that targeting one group does not mean not caring about the other group. If we do this for young adults, it does not mean that it wouldn't be great if there would be something also for the elder ones. If we are doing such a program for this age group and you feel it's a great program, why don't you come and say and help organize something for your age group? Not successful. People feel left out. People feel I'm not coming to Hanukkah because it's only for the small kids. Things like that. So I somehow, at a certain level, I resigned to that and said, okay, we need to prioritize, and we need to we need to start somewhere, and I can't stretch myself out too thin. For these psychological reasons, I need the young families there to create the atmosphere. I have elderly people, single, widowed, whatever, who are frustrated, and some of them also left. Some are there and like it. And so if anybody has a recipe for that, it would be great to
hear that. I have a different experience, and the reason I sleep very, very little, with 4 hours a day, and for long, I mean, since I remember. So I stretch out a lot. I do 7 adult education classes a week, which is a lot. I tutor, my husband and I tutor, but mostly it's almost 2/3 or a little bit more than 2/3. Every single bar mitzvah kids, I do it personally. So I'm tutoring right now 19 bar mitzvah kids, and my husband is tutoring another 8 bar mitzvah kids for the year. So, and that creates the connection with the kid, and I never leave the kid inside the office, boy or girl, so the parents come in during that tutoring. The kids hate that, some of them, but the parents love it. And so they come in, so I connect with those parents at that age. For adult education classes, I connect with a huge, you know, population of adult education, because we have at 8 o'clock at noon and at 7 o'clock at night, 3 days a week. And both we do that. So we reach that part of the population. The bar mitzvah classes, you know, we reach a lot of other part of the population. It's a very personal way, and we do it for 9 months. So really, literally, the day of the bar mitzvah is like giving birth to somebody. Mm-hmm. It's really beautiful. I mean, I personally love it. It's a lot of time consuming. For me, just to come for 2 days this time is like absolutely, I did FaceTime. I'm doing FaceTime today at the airport for bar mitzvah, you know, kids. I'm doing FaceTime all the time. And then I have the fertility group, so it's a huge group of women in that age. We do have a big gap, and it's in our area, which is youth groups. We have a big, very successful, and we are very happy with that, Jewish high school, community high school, that is very close to many of our synagogues. And the kids are taking, you know, the after-school programs over there, and that's their youth groups. BBYU is very strong. USY is not strong in our community. And so we are now trying, we are brainstorming with Barry's son, actually, of doing something together with all the youth groups and coming something that is much stronger. We do have, in our shul, a group of madrichim every Shabbat morning that are tutoring or helping the teachers on our religious school called Mahon Hadash. So the madrichim, which are 13 to 18, they get involved with that. But as far as the youth groups, it's very still very weak. But it's a lot of work. It's a lot of work. It's incredible amount of work. To reach out, to start from scratch was a lot of work. To continue that momentum, it's a lot of work. I do it with a lot of passion, but at some point it's going to take the toll.
My entire career, less so now, but my entire career, I always heard that I didn't care about the older people. So the good news is that group is getting smaller and smaller.
The young people you've cared about are now older.
Like, you know, there aren't that many people that are, you know, there are fewer people that are older than me now. But I think, you know, so I've looked at the success. The group is, the disaster people are strong. But I think when I think about the idea of, you know, of change, it's like, you know, the part of what's so difficult about it is you need to be incredibly sensitive as to what your people can bear, right? We've had a lot of rabbis lose positions over barreling through change that the community was not ready for.
Right.
Yet, at the same time, you have to be able to manage your anxiety, because not everybody's going to be happy with what it is that you're doing, whether it's change or whether you understand that you want to focus on a school for, you know, a nursery school or whatever, and the older people feel like that. So that anxiety of like, and I don't have the answer to it other than just, you know, with time it gets easier, but keeping those two things in mind. I mean, one of the things I was going to ask you, if you deal with this, but we had a congregation, that was founded to be different.
before me. And so I use that a lot. Like, well, we're still being different. The thing is that some of the people that have joined in the last 10 years didn't join because, you know, we have founding members that chose to do this thing. So you've got those people that are not so happy because, you know, we want to do this thing that was different right. forever. You've got other people that join not because they buy into that, perhaps. They buy into other things. So have you found that? Like, what happens when you found yourself to be different, but then you want to change?
Number one was the issue of how to decide for the Sidur. Okay, so you have a regular Siv Shalom, and we have a Sidur called, you know, Sidur Hadash. So the Sidur Hadash, has, and now the Lev Hadash, it's going to be a wonderful addition for us. But we chose the Sidur Hadash because we found that the alternative readings were speaking to us. But we put a huge committee of people, I mean 10 people, you know, in a committee, just to decide. We put, you know, around our table all the Sidurim, all the possible Sidurim. Art Scroll was, you know, not even in question, but it was on the table. And so we decided for Sidur Hadash. That was number one. Number two was music. Our synagogue is very musical. We have a, you know, once every 6 weeks we have a band in the shul on Friday night. My husband plays the guitar. I play the tupim. So we have constantly we have music. We have our band. It's our band in the shul. So we go from 6-year-old violin to a 74-year-old bass. So, you know, it's a lot of fun, but the music was an issue, no question. And on December 6, 2006, when the Rabbinical, when the Law Committee and Standard approved the same-sex Reut HaUvim, or commitment ceremonies, we did our first commitment ceremony two months later on February 11, 2007. And that was like a shocking thing. And we knew that probably we will lose people because of the Sidur, because of the music, before of the commitment ceremony. Nobody left because of that. Really, nobody left because of that. They we do have people that left because they said, this is not noise of children, this is sound of children. I don't think that this is a good match for you. So I asked a person to leave. I have three people that they said, just, you know, I don't think it's a good match for you. But none of them left because of music, the Sidur, or commitment ceremony.
Can you change your tunes now?
Oh, yeah. So, you know, we are constantly changing tunes because we have, sometimes, you know, I start with one and my husband goes with another one. Anyway, because you go back to Argentina with all these different synagogues, you go back to Chile, then you go to Israel, and then you learn new tunes, and, you know, and... I but we still do Lewandowski when we are in a hurry, you know, for Adon Olam. Don't go, you know, God forbid, something else. Yeah. Shoshana, you have
something. Yeah, this is a quick little question. When you're talking about change, there's so much in the press about dues and the finance of synagogue. Mm-hmm. Because I don't think this is appropriate for you because you're financed through this.
We are financed, yeah.
Right, so for you, can you speak to just very briefly and quickly how the due structure works for all of you.
Okay, so we have something in our policy that says that nobody will be kicked out of the shul, et cetera, but for financial reasons. So everybody's welcome in their own way. Then we have categories of people, you know, with double health, we have regular use of double health. Then we have a group of people that is, I think, is 7% of the shul, I couldn't go to the board meeting on Tuesday night, but I think it's 7% of the shul who has special dues. Was a big, big fuss last year because for the first time we sent, or the board sent a letter out saying, tell us why you need special dues. We are not asking you for the W-2, we are not asking you for anything. Tell us why you need, how much do you spend in entertainment? All of a sudden people realized that actually they were spending in entertainment every month, $1,000, and they were in special dues for a whole year, that was, you know, $1,500 for a whole year. So they felt like, you know, embarrassment, and so they said, you know, you're absolutely right. And so they, you know, they send, they are not in special dues anymore. So we have 28 people who were in special dues, so families that ended up not being in special dues. And then we have people that they are in special dues. And we have two families that basically, my husband and I, from our discretionary fund, we buy the groceries for them. And they are members of the shul, and nobody knows. So we have that type of structure, and then we have, you know, the donors. So our shul, big thing was, when we built the building, there were no naming opportunities. There's no names in our shul.
Wow.
Our consultants, they wanted to kill us. I mean, literally. And said, you are not going to get anywhere without naming opportunities. And I said, it's not the policy, it's not the philosophy of the shul. Everybody's equal, the $18 to the $18,000. So they said, you need $1 million here to make, well, we didn't have $1 million. So we structured it in the way in which they said, okay, so it's a capital campaign for 5 years, you can pay that. And then we asked it 6 years. By the way, we are members of our own shul. Because if I get to choose a shul where to be a member, I would choose my shul. So we are members of our own shul. And we pledge for Kol Nidre, and we do the capital campaign for 6 years, and we do the whole thing. So we are kicked out of the shul, we'll still be members, because we love people. So that's very unusual. I know that's very unusual, but it's our baby, so what can we say? I know you are thinking of a psychiatric hospital here in New York. Where do you send me right away? The structure was a very hard structure, and I don't think that we have ever been in red. I just don't think that way because everybody feels that whatever they can they give. We do have people, of course, that the other day somebody said that we want to give a certain amount of money because we want that every time that there is a program, the shul that needs those $18 for something, nobody's out of the program. Well, very nice. So they put it there, and that's what we do. Yeah.
No, I just wanted to add to what you said. We've developed a category of shomrim, of guardians. We ask them to pay three triple dues every year. And we had about 40 people who did that so that we could
right. But I do want to say something because we've really been struggling with this at my congregation because I think the issue is not just how do you structure your dues. I mean, in our congregation, nobody's turned away. They have need dues relief. The only two people they need to talk to is either me or the executive director. Their choice. Nobody knows. We don't have to see anybody's forms. It's all very lovely. The question I think that you might be asking, though, is what about this whole sense of dues? Is this, you know, transactional and, you know, and is there a new structure out there? And we've really been struggling with it at my congregation. We really are very afraid to change that, you know, because who knows what will happen. It doesn't seem to be that there's a really great model out there. It seems to me the models that I've been looking at are just dues in disguise. And I really wonder, like, we're such a, you know, we have such brilliant minds. Why can't somebody figure this out?
We have a congregation. We have a sister congregation, which is a reform one, very close to us, very successful, wonderful people, great rabbis. And they try to do with the W-2. This is what you do. This is what you give the IRS. This is the percentage. Kind of, you know, the, like churches in like with the tithe. And they were not successful. Right. I mean, they're struggling right now. They're not struggling economically because they're doing very well financially and economically, but they're struggling with this model. And I think that they're coming back, or they already came back. I don't know if Jeff or Jeff, I don't know if you know anything about that, but it's Temple Sinai. But I think that they are coming back, or they already came back to the regular, you know, old model.
So you may not want to go on this church. I just want to underline what you said, because you speak quickly and with an accent, which is charming. But when you said, tell us how much you spend on entertainment, I think that's a very interesting, I'm not criticizing it, I'm just noticing it. It's a very interesting juxtaposition. Like, you know, synagogue and you have music and so forth is sort of vis-a-vis your entertainment.
No. The reason I said that is because...
That's brilliant.
Well, we said, you know, schools, you know, clothing, you know, we do the whole thing.
Oh, the whole thing.
Entertainment was what really caught their attention.
Right, but I think because they said, we
go to the Fox Theater and we go to the movies and we go to this expensive restaurant and we cannot pay the dues. I mean, it's like...
I just think there's something in there, though, in terms of a value judgment on their part, which we're talking about a consumer-oriented, just a general statement.
Right. That's
so true. I think that's all right for us to be thinking about, and I'm not sure this is the direction you want to take.
No, but the fact that dues are, you know, dues, money, that's a big issue for another day.
As opposed to feeling the view of being part of a community. I think that, yes, that's the actual where it should go. It's frustrating. Thank you, Larry.
So, first of all, I want to say if you've only got 7% of your people on special dues, Oif Bamir Gazut. Right? Wow, that's great.
You used to have 28%.
I'd love to get my 100%. Yeah. So that's great. I have a more general question, which is, you know, when you start your own congregation, obviously, you know, you've got a lot of freedom, but many of us are stepping into congregations where the previous person has been there, in my case, 34 years. Introducing change is a big issue. And there's a lot of, in my country, there's a lot of tyranny of one, right? One person might be upset, and so we can't change anything. And I wonder if you could say a word about sort of the overall struggle, I think, that we all face. The synagogue world, congregational life, Jewish life in North America is changing so rapidly, and I think those of us who are in the trenches sort of have a sense of what we need to do. And then you get the, you know, it's like the Lewandowski thing. You know, there was a big discussion last night at my board meeting that I missed about the way we read our yard site list. We currently read the entire yard site list on Friday night. And our congregation has been around 115 years. It's a lot of dead people.
Wow.
Many of whom have no connection. I mean, we're reading names of people. People don't even know who these people are anymore. That was like the big discussion, how to raise money to like send to Nepal, not even on the table, right? So how do we look at that big issue of understanding that there's like really huge changes that are going on in the Jewish world, and our congregants and our boards are stuck on like ridiculous minutiae, and I feel like they're on the tarmac and we rabbis are up at 30 or 40,000 feet trying to like make this systemic change. Yeah, I guess that's my case right now.
And where are you, just so we know?
I'm in New York City right now. This is Columbus, Ohio.
Okay, good.
Some go to heaven, some go to hell, but everybody passes through Columbus.
I love it.
So,
I don't know if you want to go first.
I think one important piece is to. And I'm working on that also, like looking at what are those people's needs. Like if they need to if the yard sign list is something, to go back to them and ask what's good about it? You know, what does it do for you? What does it do for the shul? And not having these assumptions of this is how a shul should be run, and going into step. We had an interesting thing about the yard site. You know, people came from other schools and they said we need to put up this luach for the, where you have this lights for the yard site plaque. And then we discussed it. Everybody thought, okay, that's a great idea. And then we started discussing it and we realized we only have two people from the congregation who have died up until now, because the congregation is so new. So what would this mean? Would this mean to put up all the fathers, mothers, grandfathers, and then we would get into huge trouble since we have many converts in the congregation? What do you do about the non-Jewish parents? What do you do, especially now, Kal Vachomer in Germany, about the non-Jewish parents, grandparents? I mean, you get into a huge issue there, right? So we kind of, it was this expectation, a real shul needs a yard site board, right? And then we looked at it, what we really need, and it was clear we don't need that, right? So I think it's a matter of taking it really step by step and
so Rabbi Nachman of Slats Beikalo Lefachet Klad, right? So we grew up with a amazing role model, Rabbi Marshall Mayer, Zichrono Livracha. He said, "Ve'aikar lo le'itfachet klal." Okay, so that was our role model. Jeff was in Argentina. Actually, he started the Jewish community in Argentina, the Masorti community in Argentina. So my model growing up, and I really took it to the core, is "Ve'aikar lo le'itfachet klal." Which is when I think that something is the right thing to do, I will just go for it. And sometimes we lose some, but at least I will never say I did not try.
Right.
Okay? And so, and that's how I conduct my life, personally. And so, the fact that sometimes we will hurt people, or we'll go and apologize for hurting. But when we go into politics like that, I will say, let's see what is the right thing to do. What do you think that is the right thing to do? So I'm going to give you an example, which I was planning not to give when I told you the different difficult moments that we have, like, you know, how do you choose the sidur and it's not a regular sin shalom? How do you do the music and you know that probably you will lose people, or commitment ceremonies, briga ugot, or alvin. So those were, I would say, the easiest thing to do. So I'm a little worried that the walls of the seminary are going to shake here, but I will say it anyway. So my husband and I decided that we are going to, our congregation is a very Zionist congregation. Okay, so you look at our mission statement in Amor Mahon Hadash and says, this is a Zionist religious school. Okay, so the word Zionist comes first, always. So we decided that, are you ready? Hold it. We decided that we are following the Israeli calendar. So we said, no more Yom Tov Shemishol Galuyot. I follow the Israeli calendar. I know exactly where Israel is today. I start doing Talu Matar. I don't start on the December 5th, like the Siddur says. I start on Mar Cheshvan the 7th, the way I think it should be. So the Mar Cheshvan the 7th was not an issue because who pays attention to that, right? The Mar Cheshvan the 7th. So, you know, it says December 5th, but we were in November 23rd and people, they say that maybe they committed a mistake. We explained that. We explained that in Lasker's, from University of Beersheba, his fabulous article about why not December 5th and why yes, Mar Cheshvan the 7th. So we started with all the Israeli thing. And then 2 years ago, we said, we are one people, we eat kidneyot in Pesach, and we are one people, we have an Israeli calendar. So which parasha do you read this Shabbat? You? We read them more. Okay? And so we read them more. It's a problem. It's a mess. But we stuck with it. It's a mess because I'm preparing. The bat mitzvah girl who is doing her bat mitzvah this Shabbat, and it's reading all seven aliyot plus the maftet plus the haftorah. I prepare her for the Solomon Schechter school to read tomorrow morning. I prepare her for Acharei Mol Kedoshim. But for Shabbat, I prepare her for a more. It's a mess. It's a lot of work. It's not about just taking away the Yom Tov Sheni Shel Galuyot, who cares about that? It was a conscious decision of studying and teaching and teaching and teaching. And today it's even more complicated because people say, oh, it's the seventh day of Pesach that I have to go to a shul for Iskor, or it's on the day, it's in Isru Chag, which is Shabbat already, which is, they're already reading Shmini, but they are doing Iskor that day, or, you know, so when you have this the eighth day of Pesach like this year, and next year, Gevald, I mean, it's really complicated. It's a lot of work for us, you can imagine. You will use the trop trainer. So the trop trainer you have to put in the Israeli calendar, the trop trainer. But you have to add the part of this triennial one, which not exactly coincides. It's a mess. But we stuck with our Be'aika Lo Leit Fahed Klal. We stuck with our decision because we feel that we are one people. And today there's no reason for the Yotov Shilich Galuyot. I spoke to Golinkin, he's my rabbi too. And that's how we do it.
Come back to your question, though. We're also on the Israeli calendar, so 50 years of getting the parasha wrong. It's been fine. We've actually tweaked it a little bit, but so you're not alone, don't feel like the walls aren't shaking, or maybe they're shaking. But I want to get back to your question, because I think it's a really specific question that I really think that I hope I've made progress in my congregation about this, which is board education, as to what is a board issue and what is not a board issue. And my gut is that the Yahrzeit list is not actually a board issue. And I think that's part of, you know, but if they think it is, that's a problem, right? If they think it's their issue, then it's hard for you to just say, I'm not reading it anymore, I'm the continue reader, this is how I'm going to do it. But I think there has to be a lot of board education to understand. Now, I'm also blessed. I don't have a ritual committee, so I am the ritual committee, so I can sidestep certain things. But boards end up talking about I know, I inherited it. It was a great thing. but you have to, you have to found a congregation or inherit a congregation that was, I don't think ritual committees like voluntarily disband. So, but I do think that that's part of the issue with change, that boards get involved in things that should not be under their purview. And running a service where you're expected to read a Yahrzeit list that's going to take you an hour to read,
that's actually not even the issue. The issue is that we get people who come to hear that list read on Shabbat, And then they're actually not there for the York site, and so we have trouble making a minion. And I was like, you know, if we write it on the actual day, maybe they come and people are flipping out, you know?
So.
But I agree. I think that, you know, it is probably board education, and I love the idea, by the way, of low-leaf buffet. You know, I think that's sometimes we
just need to... It's not mine.
No, we just need to take our place, so thank you.
Deborah, the implication is that you either start a congregation or inherit, you know, a better system. Otherwise, you're stuck in the middle and you can't go anywhere. And I think
I only mean with the ritual committee. That's all.
But I think what you're saying is correct. That most of us came into congregations that were already established, that already had its traditions, and you know, we felt that we had to go with the flow and not make changes the first couple of years, and then we were fighting the board, we were fighting ritual director or whatever. I think you're right that you train your committees. You know, it's like little children. We find in the middle, you know, as we raise our kids, that all of a sudden the kids have trained us. You know, they expect things from us, and we fulfill their expectations, and then we're stuck with something we don't like. It's the same thing with the board and with the ritual committee. If you slowly work with them and you plant the idea that there are things that are not for the ritual committee to decide. These are ritual matters that are for the rabbi to decide. You want to talk about structural issues, that's fine. You want to talk about policy for the congregation in general, it's fine. You want to talk about ritual, that's my job. I'm trained for that. I'll discuss it with you. We'll study about it. But it's my decision as the rabbi. Then you slowly educate them in the way you want to go.
I will say, I have the most nimble congregation. I have a top-down congregation. We always used musical instruments on Shabbat and on the high holidays. And when I decided that it was time to introduce musical instruments on Shabbat morning, from first feeling that I was going to do that to full mode of having it be exactly as I had sort of envisioned it, 3 years. And this is in the most nimble congregation that I know. So, part of, I think, the issue is how much patience. You have to have a certain amount of patience because, and I think in other congregations, it would probably take a lot more than 3 years. Sometimes I think you do have to take the long view on some of these things because it takes a long time.
But my issue is, with everything that we're facing in the Jewish world today, I almost feel like we're being so cautious that in the meantime, you know, we're getting left in the dust,
exactly.
Right? Like, I almost feel like it's our job to, like, shake things up.
Right.
I mean, I want to do some of this crap just to, like, get people talking and, you know, get them passionate about something.
And I think you can absolutely do that as long as you can maintain your anxiety about the people that are saying the talking about what they don't like about it, you know. Anybody else? I think we have a few more minutes if people have any, you know, either great examples of change that they've, you know, facilitated or other questions.
My entire community is about change. There are people coming and going every year. So my community, this year we're going to have like 75% turnover. It's just the way the military is. 75% turnover. It's just the when people rotate out of Okinawa, anywhere in the military, it's normal. And I got lucky that I came into a community that actually stabilized and was together for 62 full years. And that's a rarity. So I deal with change all the time. They come in and they have to learn. I mean, look, I don't have a board. They don't pay me, right? They don't, look, I'm the only rabbi on the island. You don't like me? Don't show for 2.5 years, 3 years. You'll get a new rabbi. Me. So you have a choice. It's either me or nobody, right? So I've had people try to please everybody, and they want all the different touches and sounds and music from home, and they're coming from all over the world. I can't please anybody, right? So part of what it came down to was I spent a lot of time with that personal one-on-one, with everyone who I knew had was upset with the previous rabbi, and with me, and so that one-on-one was a great opportunity, and then me being able to say, all right, well, you want that to happen, show up. You can't complain to me and say, I want Passover over at the, names are relevant, but the club that's on base that is mamash, like, beyond treif for Pesach, of all things, and I say to you, no, I'm conjuring the kitchen, and if you want to complain about the food, show up and help cook. And they say, no. I said, I don't care about your opinion. Mind you, I have that ability. right? I don't have a board. I don't have any of. I am the ritual committee, right? Right. So part of it has been the buy-in of the community, and I say, here's what I have to offer. I will give you anything that you need. Hebrew school, I will teach Hebrew school, right? I got B'nai Mitzvah. I didn't realize I had B'nai Mitzvah. I have conversion candidates, right? Completely unexpected, and then the community turns over every year. So the need to be able to create some sort of consistency has been about that one-on-one, and then being able to say, you're with me on this journey. Come with me on this. Let's build this together. Right? Has been incredible, and that has, I think, it's one of the reasons why it's been so successful.
So I really have a question to all of you, because I've tried the same thing of saying, you know, if you want this to happen, go ahead and do it. And people felt like I'm brushing them off. Because that would also, you know, if you want somebody to care about Nepal, you need two people to do it and let them do it. So how do you do that? Like, tell them, go ahead and do it, and still they seem to need more support than just that. I mean, maybe not in the military, but maybe in other places.
I've got little 18, 19, 20-year-olds who show up to services and they're just like, so it's cute.
I think that they're
very sweet. But here's my answer is, I work with the assumption that they don't know anything.
Okay.
Right? I have a very reformo conservative community, which means I have to do a lot more English than I feel comfortable doing. We use the Likracha on Friday nights because it's got as much translation and transliteration as possible. It's a line that Rick Sherwin uses, which is Basher Ushan, right, being where they are. Mm-hmm. And so I use that with everything. So if I have five people who say, who came to me and said, listen, you know, we know that you're teaching the Hebrew school, you know, Hebrew school each kids, but you're not doing adult ed. Mm-hmm. I'm like, I got it, let's do adult ed. What do you want? Mm-hmm. And their answer to me is, right, I don't even know where to start with the question.
But I think that if you change,
I work with them is really what it comes down to.
Okay.
I don't. Okay. Right. I'll say, if you want to do this, here's the research. Let me give you the websites I want you to look at. Here's some information. I give them the starting point and say, then come back to me with the information.
Okay.
Part of it is teaching them because they don't know. Right. If you want to say, you know, fundraising for Nepal, they don't. I got to be honest. People are wonderful, but I argue that you need to guide them. We need to be their, not these military terms, we need to be their shepherds. They do. And sometimes they want the hand-holding. And they'll tell us if they want less or more. But we need to be present with them on the journey. Even if it's something you say, all right, let's run with it. It's let's, not you. Right? And then when you can kind of take the training wheels off, then you can.
I'm Aaron Weininger, I'm a rabbi in Minneapolis. And two thoughts come to mind. One is the energy of the clergy team. You have colleagues in a clergy team, I think that radiates a certain energy in the rest of the congregation. And think about an example of a Shabbat morning service that we started in my synagogue, a musical Shabbat service, and there was really no resistance to using instruments, but kind of from the beginning, we brainstormed how can we engage congregants as musicians in that. Mm-hmm. And to kind of preempt any kind of concern, not to make it a clergy initiative, but to make it a congregational initiative, where there's buy-in from the onset and there are people very visible in roles where they're working with the rabbis and with the cantor so that it's a team effort. And any critique or any feedback comes to all of us and it feels like a joint partnership in that regard. So it feels exciting rather than kind of evocative of trepidation or anything else.
That's exactly what I was, when you were talking, if you change the words, go ahead and do it. By let's do it,
right. Yeah.
Changes the whole the feeling of like, you know, we are all as a team doing this, and it's beautiful, and that's why you see the passion, because you really combine that passion with your congregant, and so it's very fulfilling.
I also think it's really important to be clear in your own mind when you're launching something new. Is your goal the development of your lay leadership and the people you're working with, or is your goal the program, mm-hmm. and what it represents in your strategic plan? There are times when it's going to be here,
right.
or I'm
right.
sort of too, but there are some programs where I'm launching something and I hand it over to somebody and I'm thinking, if it's in my hands, there's like maybe a 60-40 chance of success, and if it's in their hands, more 40-60 or 30-70, but I'm willing to let that be because it's important for them to have the experience of being able to take a risk and try something and then us talk over
what were the parts that worked and what were the parts that worked less well, and let's think about what it's going to look like next time. And there are other times where it's like, no, this has really got to be a success first time off, because there's enough resistance in the community or enough skepticism about this that if it's the flop the first time, there won't be the people in the room to see it succeed the second or third time round. And I don't always guess it right, but I think that's important for me as a metric in Manja or something. Mm-hmm.
I'm Julia Andelman. I work here at JTS, and I'm a member of a synagogue now, and I wanted to respond directly to what you said, but this happened to me very recently, where there was a meeting of parents in our synagogue, and there was some of us were expressing dissatisfaction with the service for the littlest kids. And I live in Teaneck, where there are about 40 of our colleagues who are members of the shul. It's a very active lay leadership right now. But this was an area where, like, I don't happen to have expertise in two-year-old Shabbat morning services. But the vibe at our shul is, if you want something done, you know, get up and do it yourself. And that's what we were told. And I didn't react very positively to it, because I said, you know, I'm happy to do that in the areas where I have expertise, which I think are plenty, and this isn't one of them. And, you know, our shul is not, there maybe are, we actually happen to have in our shul people who could train the rest of us, or we have so many Jewish educators in our shul. But I think overall, yes, you know, if you want it done, then please step in and do it is a nice kind of mentality, but it also requires a sensitivity about whether or not people have the skills or perceive themselves as having the skills to do that thing. And my response in that particular moment was, actually, if this is a priority of our community, we may need external support, and I need the rabbinic leadership to prioritize that. And it needed to be a partnership moment instead of a you step up and do it moment.
Okay. You have a great point that I think is very valuable for all of us. Sometimes we have this wonderful group of volunteers that they know how to do everything, and so we burn them out. I mean, it's like we are asking the same people all the time to do things, yeah. And we have to be extremely careful with our, you know, anxiety management of something that wants to make it done. And so we ask the same people just to do it because you want to make it done. So if you do that, just to remember, you know, to thank them and to do it, you know, if they're public people, to do it publicly as well. I think that we have a tendency, you know, when we feel extremely comfortable in our own shoes, just to delegate, knowing that if that 37% is good this time, it's going to be 68%, you know, next time, and then it will be a successful product. But I think that we have tendencies of, like, we put people that not necessarily their expertise is where we're asking things to do for us, and we burn them, and so they're going to say no to the next time. So just to be very careful.
We're going to do something really radical in the Jewish world. We're going to end the session on time. But I really want to thank both of you so much. You know, we talk about ourselves as an international movement, and then we don't always get to see it, but I think this morning we did get to see with a wealth of experience of our panelists from the various places that they've lived and where they're, what they're doing now, and in such different communities. So thank you so much.